Music of Philip Glass that you have not heard before, in all likelihood, because you will have the opportunity to hear the Chicago premiere of his Fall of the House of Usher, based on the story of Edgar Allan Poe, of course. And you're going to be able to hear it. It's not recorded because of Long Beach, California, and Chicago Opera Theater, two cities, two organizations that now have a very interesting connection. And the connection is with us today because the connection is human. It's Andreas Mitasek. Am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Andreas is the new general director of Chicago Opera Theater. Not so new now in terms of administrative work and planning, but really getting ready to take on Chicago and to have Chicago connect with him in a very public sense, because the 2013 season of COT is about to begin with the Fall of the House of Usher, February 23rd through March 1st. It's the first of three productions that will be going on, and there'll be other ancillary activities. Maybe we'll have a chance to touch on them in our conversation too. But Maria de Buenos Aires of Astro Piazzolla will take to the Harris Theater for Music and Dance in Millennium Park stage in April. And then in September, Joan of Arc, Giovanna d'Arco of Giuseppe Verdi, September of 2013, all works that you have not had a chance to see or hear in all probability, and all of them being brought to us by COT. Andreas, welcome to Chicago, even though you've been here for a while, but welcome to WFMT. I know it's your first time here.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. I like your little house here.
Good, good. We like it too. You, as far as I can tell, both from reading about you, talking to you, talking to other people about you, you do everything. Your title is general director at COT, and is it a similar title at Long Beach? Or
yes, it's a similar title. We also add artistic and talent director.
Okay, but you yourself are a pianist, a conductor, a stage director, a designer. Is there something you don't do that is related to opera?
No, actually, I do anything and everything that is related to opera.
Yeah.
I think that's the great part about it. You know, I come, I came to it as a musician from the musical side, but I have a very strong visual and also theatrical sense, and that eventually led me to these other avenues to kind of incorporate that in a, so to speak, Gesamtkunstwerk.
In a total work of art. Tell us about your background. Tell us where you come from and what your initial training was.
Well, I'm from good old Vienna, and I studied there at the Conservatory and the Musikhochschule, as it was called back then.
Right. Not,
I think it's the Music University. Initially, my majors were there besides piano. I was imagining to be a harpsichordist and organist, you know, as a soloist concert. And so that's what I started doing. And in that context, I did a lot of chamber music and then oratorios. And somehow the voice came in, mm-hmm. even though I have to say opera wasn't really my thing.
Do you come from a musical family, or were you the child that nobody knew where he came from who was always running to a keyboard to play?
Well, if you have a keyboard at home, and that's what we actually had. We had an upright piano because my mother had played when she was young, and it was sitting there until I came along.
I see. But your parents were not musicians or?
No, I'm the only one, the mm-hmm. so-called black sheep.
So at what point then was this where opera, which hadn't been your thing, or was it through accompanying singers or doing recitals? Or
yeah, I actually, you know, I got a job at the conservatory also being a coach, and that was for singers. I also was actually in the voice class at the conservatory uh-huh. for a while, and then I got a job at the opera as a correpetitor or as a coach.
Right.
Which the English word is for that.
With a coach or rehearsal pianist or even assistant conductor.
Yeah. And You know, through that, I developed the appreciation for the art form, even though not everything I saw and heard was to my liking.
Well, I would imagine particularly when you were growing up, much of what was presented in Vienna, much still that is presented in Vienna as opposed to some other interesting theaters and festivals in Austria, was pretty, I don't even want to say traditional because it's not very fair to the tradition. It was very stuffy and unimaginative and old-fashioned, wasn't it?
Well, I think, you know, one of the great things was that the state opera was on my way to the conservatory. So any time in the evening I would go by to see if there was something that was of interest, and I would go in and, you know, standing room, as we all probably have done.
Right.
That's how I learned about it. And in a repertoire house like that, you can have wonderful performances or you can have really crappy ones. Mm-hmm. Depends on the evening. But a lot of times also, at least during the 80s, you had a lot of productions that were maybe 30, 40 years old.
Yeah.
I think some of them are still performed there. Just as a reference for me, it opened a little bit the world, but it was never something that was really theatrically engaging.
Right.
There were some exceptions.
Was there a place or an event or a production that somewhere that got you as onto what you would like to do or would like to connect with? Or was it just more, I don't want to do things like this?
I think, it's a little hard to trace that development. But eventually, I like music, I like theater, and I like the combination of both of it. And then sometimes you call it opera. Or, again, in German, we have another good word, Musiktheater.
Right.
Which is not musical theater. But, it's the combination of music and theater. And,
right.
And that's what I'm interested in. It's storytelling.
Was there a theater company? Was there a town? Was there a festival? Was there a television broadcast? Something where you saw something that...
No, not really. No. Actually, I founded an opera company in Vienna, actually,
right,
with a friend of mine when I was 22 or something,
right,
where we said, well, we want to do something different.
And
we,
right. So it really was more not seeing what you wanted to do, and you and your friend said, let's do it.
Right.
Okay.
I had started that pretty early, I would say, and, you know, no one would, in Austria, nothing is privately funded, so everything is state funded. So in order to do something, you have to convince some people to help you make it happen.
I don't think there were, I hope there were not bribes involved, but...
but I have to say, you know, on a little sad note, to some regard, I sold my harpsichord for my first opera.
Whoa.
To produce my first opera.
So I think the fun cliche in this country, tradition, such as it is for the arts, is Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, let's put on a show. And they create a musical theater in their farm, in their barn. And for Viennese, let's put on an opera, right?
I mean,
that's what you did. We'll sell the harpsichord if we need to.
Yeah, fits right in there.
What was your first production?
Well, that was, you know, it was pretty standard. It was Abduction from the Serail.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the place where we did it is this psychiatric hospital, mm-hmm, on the outskirts of Vienna.
Right.
It was built by Otto Wagner,
right,
beginning of the 1900s. And in the middle of it, which was very modern for these times, they had a little theater,
right,
which was dormant for many years. And so that kind of became our home, mm-hmm, and also our window to very interesting mental worlds.
Right, right. Well, Otto Wagner, I think, would have, and probably Richard too, would have appreciated what you were doing out there, because it is an amazing area. And this idea, when it was created, that there should be a theater for the residents, and that there should be this chapel space that's very theatrical, and these wonderful murals and so on. I mean, and yet all this green around you too. I mean, it must have been. Let's go put on a show there again. Can we tour Chicago Opera Theater?
It was a wonderful time. We did this for about 7-8 years.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, even though we started out with Abduction, we ventured into more modern repertoire. We did the first Austrian production of Le Grand Macabre.
Ligeti.
Yeah. We did Devils of Lodin by Paderewski. We did the Austrian premiere of a Harrison Birchwitz opera.
Mm-hmm.
The second Mrs. Kong. Very promising title.
Right.
so we really filled in a niche between the Staatsoper, the Vienna State Opera, and the Volksoper. You know, state opera, mostly traditional repertoire, standard repertoire, and then the Volksoper, more the operetta, musical, also some lighter opera.
Right.
And it was the so-called freie Szene, mm-hmm. the free scene of right. young and upcoming people doing theater and operas.
What was the name of your company?
Wiener Operntheater, Vienna Opera Theater.
Right. And then what happens? Something perhaps involving the United States?
I had started conducting operas, so to speak. I did also productions at the Wiener Volksoper, and then I worked at the Komische Oper in Berlin.
Right.
And for whatever reason it was, I said I want to work in the U.S. And actually the first company I heard about that would be interesting for what I was doing was Long Beach Opera in California.
And how had you heard about them?
Because a singer that I had worked with in Vienna, we did Death in Venice mm-hmm. by Benjamin Britten, told me about it, and he was from New York originally, and I was doing a little tour, and so somehow that contact came about.
We're speaking with Andreas Mitisek, Mitisek. He is the new general director of Chicago Opera Theater, which is about to launch its 2013 season with Philip Glass, The Fall of the House of Usher, and then Astor Piazzolla, and a rarity of Giuseppe Verdi. We'll come to all of those as we go along, but we're talking now about Andreas Goes to Long Beach. Tell us about Long Beach Opera, and tell us about how it does or does not connect to Los Angeles. I don't mean Los Angeles Opera, I mean the region. I think for a lot of people outside of, I don't want to say outside of California, because even Northern Californians get confused about this. Outside of Southern California, tell us a bit about the company and the region there.
Well, everything in Los Angeles takes at least half an hour by car. Doesn't matter where you go. It was very interesting the first time I was there, you know, being naive from Vienna where you take public transportation around the corner, the post office is right at the next corner. I asked someone, so where's the next post office? And they said, oh, just down the street and then you turn right. It took me 20 minutes to get to the end of that street
right.
by
right.
car.
Right, right.
So, it's a big geographical area. And so Long Beach and Los Angeles, I almost like to say it's like Northwestern University and the Loop.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. They are different cities, but all our audience comes from all over the area.
Right.
So LA and Long Beach are kind of really next to each other.
And one of the many interesting things that you've done at Long Beach is that you've taken advantage of the fact that there was no single opera house. There was no directly logical place by old thinking to put things on. And you've taken that canvas of geography that goes from the ocean to land to naval bases to warehouses to museums to aquariums, and you've made that the home of Long Beach Opera.
Yeah, because I see, putting on an opera is only one, is the center of other things that happen around that visit. So for me, it's the journey to that event that is important. For me, it's important the experience at this place where we bring people together. So I think theaters are great, but often if you have a space that really reflects the theme of what you're about to see, I think your own sensibility changes. You know, it might be a place that is uncomfortable. We did The Diary of Anne Frank in an underground parking garage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who would think about sitting in a parking garage for an hour?
Yeah.
But who would think about living in an attic for 2 years?
Right.
So I think there was a metaphor that really worked very well and gave the audience that uncomfortable feeling of being at a place where they didn't want to really be.
Right.
And experiencing that story, it makes a big difference. So it's not just about putting on an opera, but it's giving an experience. That's what I look to.
I think it was one or two productions ago you used an aquarium.
Yes, we did. It was just last September. We collaborated with the aquarium in Long Beach, which is one of the biggest aquariums in the country. And there's a piece by Gavin Bryars, the Paper Nautilus. It's kind of a song cycle of some sort about the beauty of the ocean. It's kind of a trip into the depth of the ocean. Six percussionists is the orchestra, two singers. And so we had a performance in front of the huge tank in the aquarium, where also the tank became part of the performance with lights. And I like to see the fish even dance to the music.
I was curious what kind of response you got from the permanent residents. So
very cooperative.
Grand opera companies, we're witnessing this right now in Chicago, and similar thing happened in New York when they changed intendants or general directors. They have to plan their seasons years, literally, in advance, and a new director comes in and has to follow at least the titles and some of the contracts, of course, for singers and conductors that have that he or she has inherited. In your case, a smaller company, lower budget, more flexibility, but you've got physical inheritance so that your first season at least is going to be in a theater. But I imagine there's some advantage to having the time before that season, and you had taken over in a supervisory role and a planning role at the time of Magic Flute, which came from the Brian Dickey era. But I imagine by having this year and a half, 2 years, where you're getting to know Chicago and getting to see how your productions work at the Harris, that's probably a good thing rather than just trying to immediately come in and get people to go to an underground parking garage.
Well, it's getting for me to get to know our audience and also for the audience to get to know me. And I think, you know, through that sensibility of kind of dating, we find out how quickly we want to go to different places.
The operatic OK Cupid is going on.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, over the next 5 years, my goal is to expand the company to five productions a year, which I think is a good size for what CUT can do. And I think is its place here is in the community. And so my goal is to have performances at the Harris, which is our home, and it's a great theater. But also I think we need to go out in the community. We need to venture out and meet our audiences and new audiences in places where they feel comfortable. And also in places that I think, like, you know, we experienced in Long Beach, add to the experience of the performance.
And I think you're also talking about meeting communities, not just geographical places and spaces, but meeting communities that either have not been directly connected to opera or might have had a feeling opera is, quote, not for us or this kind of thing. And even Lyric is moving pretty dramatically in that direction because their director coming previously from Houston, where he had done a mariachi opera, and finding the communities in Pilsen and Waukegan in addition to the Opera House. So these are things you bring from your Long Beach experience. You also, for those people listening, think, oh my gosh, here's this company. It's small. They work hard to break even. I mean, small compared to Scala, Vienna, Chicago, or the Met. They work hard to break even, and he wants to go to five productions. But you've also got this secret weapon, which is this connection with Long Beach, where there will be some productions shared between the two companies. And it's not like people are running off every week between Long Beach and Chicago Opera Theater to see productions. So these really will be opportunities here. And I think it's important to say also that, of course, for now, you're bringing us things you've been doing that started there. But it doesn't mean that you won't also be bringing things to Long Beach that start in Chicago, right?
Right. All of that is is in my thinking and the possibilities. I think the combination between Long Beach Opera and Chicago Opera Theater is unique in the country because these are the two companies who are on a regular basis throughout their seasons present works that are rare, unusual, you know, of all ages and times. And they are far enough away from each other. So as you say, you know, except me, no one jumps on a plane every week going back and forth. And besides having an economical, you know, efficiency, there's a great artistic, actually, potential in there. For us combining our set budgets, our, you know, costume budgets, but also giving singers an opportunity to sing more than just four performances right. in one of those cities, four right. works they often just learn for these engagements.
And that might not be presented again for a very long
right.
time.
Right. So it's really, you know, I'm very grateful to both boards that they also have seen this opportunity in making this happen.
How did you set on the Glass Opera? This is a work that was written for and done on the East Coast about 14 years ago and then kind of disappeared.
Yeah, it was written in the late 80s, 87.
Oh, so it was longer than that, okay. Yeah. So 24 years ago.
Yeah, around the Akhenaten time.
Right.
It was written for the American Repertory Theater in Boston. And, you know, which is not an opera house, right. but it fits well into what Philip Glass very often does so well, crossing the boundaries.
And as you mentioned, Akhenaten, which was a Chicago Opera Theater production, and American Repertory is now headed by Diane Paulus, right, who
yeah.
started really her real career through Chicago Opera Theater. So it's definitely, you can already feel these things connecting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's, and you know, Long Beach Opera did Akhenaten, actually,
right.
a couple of years ago. We also did Nixon in China in Long Beach, and that was at Chicago Opera Theater. So there's a lot of similarity
yeah.
in repertoire.
Right.
The Philip Glass, written in 1987, is, I think it's a wonderful gem that combines two, one of the most important American figures, you know,
right.
Edgar Allan Poe on the one side, and then bringing in the sensibility of Philip Glass
right.
to this really enigmatic story. I think he's the ideal composer, actually, to write the music for this opera.
Not whoever was making the soundtracks for Roger Corman and Vincent Price back in the days. So this was something that was on your radar for Long Beach and then Long Beach and Chicago. Of course, there's a history here with COT, with Lyric, and Philip went to the University of Chicago, so there's also that nice connection. And he has a cousin who has a popular radio show that started in Chicago. That would be Ira Glass. They're from Baltimore. What about the Piazzolla? How does that come into the picture?
Well, Astor Piazzolla wrote one work for the stage, and there was Maria de Buenos Aires. He called it Tango Operita. So tango opera, little opera. I have done a production of this in 2004, in my early years in Long Beach, and it was more standard, traditional, like you would expect from, you know, tango operetta. You think tango dancing and some of these cliches along, which fits beautifully, but I wanted to do it again. And so I said it during the Dirty War of the 1970s in Argentina.
Right.
And, you know, the libretto for Maria de Buenos Aires is very poetic. It's a lot of allegorical, metaphorical poetry by Horacio Ferrer. So it is also very open to actually different explorations. And basically it's the story of Maria, personification of Buenos Aires, how Buenos Aires came to life and, you know, the struggles and the defeats and the victories of some sort. It kind of encompasses also the Argentinian people as themselves. And for me, that is a metaphor of the struggle during the dictatorship in 1970s, you know, over 30,000 people disappeared.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling.
And some of them still, you know, their parents are still looking for,
right.
or their sons.
Right.
So I think also the music by Astor Piazzolla, you know, and tango in general is very aggressive, passionate. It's, you know, it rips a wound open and puts the finger right in there.
And how will you be handling the choreographic elements of this?
Well, it's storytelling combined with movement,
right.
you know, and I hesitate to say dance because it's not about dance. It's about movement, and dance can be movement and movement can be dance.
Let's hear some of the music from Maria de Buenos Aires of Astor Piazzolla.
Yo soy María de Buenos Aires, María, no ven quién soy yo. María tango, María del arrabal, María noche, María pasión fatal, María del amor, de Buenos Aires soy yo. Yo soy María de Buenos Aires. Si en este barrio la gente pregunta quién soy, pronto muy bien lo sabrán las hembras que me envidiarán y cada macho a mis pies como un ratón en mi trampa de caer. Yo soy María de Buenos Aires, soy la más bruja cantando y amando también. Si el bandoneón me provoca, tiaratata, le muerdo fuerte la boca, tiaratata, con 10 espasmos en flor que yo tengo en mi ser. Siempre me digo, dale María, cuando un misterio me viene trepando la voz. Y canto un tango que nadie jamás cantó, y sueño un sueño que nadie jamás soñó, porque el mañana soy con el ayer después. Che.
Music of Astor Piazzolla, Maria de Buenos Aires. That will be the April production 2013 at the Harris Theater of Chicago Opera Theater. You're listening to Critical Thinking. I'm your host and producer for this series, Andrew Patner. You're listening to WFMT 98.7 FM and via free streaming on WFMT.com. We're talking with Andreas Mitizek. Andreas is the general director of Chicago Opera Theater and the general and artistic director, which is also what he is here, but they have a longer title there, of Long Beach Opera. He comes from Vienna as well as from Long Beach, and he is a musician, and he's a man of the theater, as they used to say, and they should say again. And you've also designed things. You've made costumes.
Yes, I did. I mean, not okay. personally, but decided what they should look like, okay. and then someone else made
them. Right, that. But I mean, you designed them.
Yeah, I had when we did actually Akhenaten by Philip Glass, 2011. I directed, designed. Production design, everything, the costumes right. and the production.
But we don't need to get concerned that you might leave Chicago to start the Mitezek line of suits or dresses or something like this.
No, but that's okay. a good idea. I have to think about that.
Only if the money comes back into the theater, right? So you follow a very interesting and unusual history, even for a relatively young and relatively small company. The founder was Alan Stone. Alan was interested in young singers, in an idea that some people today wonder where did it even come from, but cast your mind back before supertitles, the idea of opera in English. He also had an interest in American work, and these three things somehow fit and didn't fit and worked for some time, and many, many interesting people got their starts at Opera Theater. There then was a period where Larry Rapchak and Carl Ratner took it over. That included the Akhenaten, and they also continued, especially that American commitment, and we saw things like Shining Brow on Frank Lloyd Wright. And then Brian Dickey came, somebody with a very distinguished career at medium-sized houses all around. And this idea of taking works from before and after, you could say, the general repertoire of lyric opera, and of course a special interest continuing with young singers and that work. And in that period, we also, I think, saw a lot of Baroque opera. So now we come to a period that seems much more connected to 21st century and to later 20th century, but not exclusively so. And maybe you can talk about how you see not so much even a season, because especially when there are only three, but how you see a period of years and what you see as some of the components.
Well, three is hard, you know. That's why we have to get to five. You know what you said about Alan Stone, young singers, which of course Brian also fostered, opera in English, American opera. All of these things are also things that I'm interested in. You know, right. I think there's a lot of wonderful operas of American composers out there that also deal with American, you know, themes. So I'm certainly interested in that, continuing that. I also think that it is important to give a diverse repertoire, you know, and that is, again, can be from 1700 or can be from 2013. I think it all should come under, not under a segment of, classification, you know, right. This is Baroque, this is classic, and now this is contemporary. I like to see it all as I said again, you know, this is a brand of an experience, of an adventure. You know, and I have right. come to rebrand my understanding of opera as an acronym that I say, you know, these are experiences. They are outside the box, provocative, engaging, relevant, and adventurous.
I'm going to test our listeners if they can fill that in for OPERA, but I like it.
I think, you know, this is what it is. Opera has so much cliche attached to some regard, good and bad ones. You know, a lot of good, wonderful things for the ones who know it and love it. And then it's sometimes hard to bring people in who don't know it and have only heard from the outside about it. Right. So that's where I think having a wide range of all kinds of different repertoire and musical styles is important.
Once Brian had been here for a while, he and some of his board and staff came up with this interesting idea whose purpose was both to raise money but also to kind of throw a wild card into the deck. And this was the, I never quite took to the title, the People's Opera. And you could vote by giving $1 per vote, which was very Chicago, that part. But the choices were not necessarily people's choices that you could start with, the ballot, you know. But we got some very interesting things out of it, the Shostakovich, Moscow Cherrytown, and other things. And there was one still hanging in the air, what would happen to Giovanna d'Arco, Joan of Arc, which is after Nabucco but before most other things, and perhaps one of the least produced of Verdi's operas. And tell us about what you decided to do with Giovanna d'Arco.
Well, it was voted to be done by CUT audiences, and, you know, I'm looking forward to giving it to them. So, you know, vote with your dollars, and here will be Giovanna d'Arco. Actually, I think it's a very interesting work in the sense of from the time it came from, mm-hmm. also from the time, you know, when it was composed and what Giovanna d'Arco was looked for, or, you know, what the idol she was in, you know, thinking about the time that Verdi had, you know, a lot of wars going on.
We're talking about between, around 1845, yeah?
Yeah. And interesting also the play he chose to set to music through, of course, his librettist by Schiller, you know, which dealt again the sacrifice of your personal fortune or luck for your country. And it's a very interesting how that is explored. Now, I think there's a lot to be found in for our time, too.
And what about how you will be thinking about it in terms of musical and stage presentation? I mean, this will be the one work of this season that requires a quote-unquote traditional orchestra.
Yeah, and, you know, all that will be there. I think it has wonderful musical numbers, big chorus numbers, which we know, you know, the power from Nabucco kind
right.
of carried over.
And requires a major soloist, too.
Yep, three.
You I was thinking of Joan, but
Joan,
yes,
you do
need
Joan, and then, you know, you need the tenor.
Yes.
And then there is the baritone.
Right.
So it's it has three big roles that are very important. I have decided to hire a stage director I've worked with quite a bit. He comes from theater, uh-huh. and we have done Montezuma by Antonio Vivaldi.
Right.
An American premiere, and kind of, again, a work that is really done and kind of put a different twist on it, you know. And so...
What's the name of this director?
David Schweitzer.
Okay. I love that idea that the Vivaldi opera about the Americas gets its American premiere 350 years after the fact in Long Beach. I mean, that's the beauty of American opera, isn't it? That American opera is working from any tradition it wants to, and it's got both a clean slate and roots in every area. You have the Germans who came across the country and built these opera houses in the craziest places. You have the Italians who came and pushed them out, took over these opera houses, and became fanatical supporters of them. You have the composers, you have the stories based here, you have Verdi having to move a story to Boston, which he didn't know anything about. But this can happen here. And obviously that also takes us back to a 20-something Andreas thinking, wow, maybe I could really go from one city of opera, Vienna, to a city that can be a city of opera in California and make these things happen and make these dreams come true.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, Long Beach, where I have been now for 10 seasons, this is my 10th season in Long Beach, it's interesting to see how this company has grown in the last 10 years with its audience. You know, our subscriber base has grown by over 500% throughout the recession there.
Yeah.
When I came there, we had two productions in a festival format. It was a company that had sometimes more, but a lot of times less productions. Now we have a season of four main stage productions, and we have one outer limits series, right. as I like to call it. So we have 5 operas spread out through the season. And it's just wonderful to see if we also trust our audience to be adventurous, that they are. And I think a lot of the time, you know, I mean, any of the programming we do there, no one knows the titles, but that's our goal.
Right.
There's so much wonderful repertoire out there that no one knows about.
Right.
You know, I have a list of 50 operas.
Sure.
We could do without repeating ourselves.
Right.
And that's where all these different locations where we go to in this big area, where we also have found new audiences that didn't right. think opera was for them.
I think that the point of trusting the audience and challenging them, not in an aggressive way, but in a way that says, we know that you want an interesting experience. And once you do that, it just changes everything. And we should say, too, that Andreas has been working on some very innovative ways of supporting innovative work. And you got a tiny little grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation of $500,000, right?
Yes, we did a $500,000 grant over 3 years, I'm sorry to say, to support American works, one a year, and also support a cash reserve, you know, the everyday business that we have to do in order to make these things
happen.
And that's
something that, for reasons that had nothing to do with the recent direction, but just the history of how companies go up and down. This is something COT has never had before and is very important for you to be able both to plan and to do the current work without going crazy or crazier. Right?
That is true. I mean, you know, wearing two hats, being an artist but also an administrator, I know what I want to see on stage and I know what I need to pay for it. So it's a very interesting conversation I have with myself.
Just to close what is only the first of what I'm sure we hope will be many conversations with Andreas over the years that he is now making Chicago a home as well. But I'm just curious, I won't hold you to any of it, and I'm not asking for great philosophical treatise, but what's your impression of Chicago? What's your impression of the music or theater that you've had the chance to take in? Is there something that characterizes it for you so far?
Well, I think, you know, it's a wonderfully diverse city in its cultural offerings. You know, I mean, theater is a big thing here. And so in many ways, I'm kind of reminded of a cultural richness like I have experienced it in Vienna. So there's a lot of old tradition in making culture part of our lives. You know, right. I grew up with that idea.
Yes.
You know that you're involved in it, and so that is very exciting for me to kind of come halfway between Los Angeles and Vienna, here in Chicago, where American sensibility mixes together with a kind of, if I like to say, European style.
Oh, I would agree. Well, we're very glad that you came in, and we're very glad that your season is going to start. Power of Love, Love of Power. Ooh, there's some more branding for you. If you're listening to our initial broadcast on the 18th, then this weekend is the opening weekend for the Fall of the House of Usher, Philip Glass and Edgar Allan Poe, February 23rd through March 1st. And whenever you're listening, Astro Piazzolla, Maria de Buenos Aires, is in the third and fourth weeks of April, and in September, Joan of Arc, Giovanna d'Arco of Giuseppe Verdi, the last 10 days of September. And if you are wondering, does Mr. Mitaszek have guts to present a Verdi opera in the new home of Riccardo Muti in the month that he will be in Chicago? So we have to get him over to the Harris, presenting many Verdi programs. This shows you this is a guy who has the Chicago I Will spirit, which is very much in the tradition, the eclectic tradition of his predecessors at COT. We're going to go out with music from Verdi's Joan of Arc, But first, I just want to say thank you so much to Andreas Mitizek for coming in and talking with us today. And we look forward to having you back soon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you all at the Harris for our Usher.
Music that we heard tonight We opened with an excerpt from Fall of the House of Usher by Philip Glass, and that was our guest, Andreas Mitezek, just a few weeks ago, conducting the Long Beach Opera Chamber Orchestra, our opening excerpt. Midway through, we heard from Maria de Buenos Aires of Astor Piazzolla, Joy Soy Maria, I Am Maria, Julia Zenko, Gidon Kremer and his ensemble Kremerata from their 1997 recording. And we closed with, I bet you guessed, Giovanna d'Arco, Giuseppe Verdi. Yes, that was Montserrat Caballé as Giovanna, and I am sure you recognize the voices of two gentlemen named Domingo and Milnes as Carlo VII di Francia, Charles VII, and Giacomo. James Levine conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, all recorded in 1972, Abbey Road, London. I'd like to thank Andreas Mitezek again for coming in. I'd like to thank Eric Etherly for helping us to arrange this interview, Matt DeStefano for recording it and making it sound great. As always, our sponsors, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought of this or any of our programs. Drop us a line. Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. Or visit us online, WFMT.com, and click on the Chime In feature and chime right in. WFMT.com/critical thinking takes you to this or any of our other programs at the always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week. The beauty of American opera, isn't it? And
right.
Of opera. That
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. It's the first time you've ever done that.
I know.
Wow.
How about that?
You're fine.
No. Yeah.